Contracts, salary caps. Why do our favorite teams make some of the moves they do? It's usually the money. It's time for the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to another edition of the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt. I saw a piece in the New York Times, really interesting, about cheerleading, primarily in the NFL. So many women for so few jobs. They sign these contracts of adhesion, these NDAs. They're sent out there. They actually go into parking lots. They go into suites of season ticket holders. And even in one case, going into homes where they're groped, they're harassed. They can't even have any fraternization with players. Really is an interesting piece on how this sexualization of cheerleaders started way back when. The authors of the piece, Juliette McCurr and John Branch in the New York Times, now ahead on the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.
Welcome, Juliette. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Hello, glad to be here.
The name of your article in New York Times this week is Pro Cheerleaders Say Groping and Sexual Harassment Are Part of the Job. And reading through it, it's just striking. Some of the things that these girls, these ladies go through. Just want to give you guys a blank slate right at the beginning and talk about what hit you most in your reporting of this issue, what stuck out to you, and we can get into some of the granular details that you reported, but kind of a basic headline beyond the one I read in terms of what you found out in reporting about these cheerleaders. First you, John.
Sure. What struck me is that every cheerleader that I talk to has these kinds of stories, these kinds of war stories. And whenever they are sent out into the stands or onto the concourse, or in some cases after the tailgates into the parking lots, or even to some special events or promotions, parties way offsite, there's an expectation, even among the cheerleaders, that they are going to be treated poorly. They'll be verbally harassed. They'll be looked up and down. They might be judged, and people will tell them how they look. And in a lot of cases, they will be touched and groped. They all told me stories about walking through crowds and people are always grabbing their arm to get their attention, and walking into suites and sometimes dreading it because I know the guys behind a certain suite door at a stadium will be pretty liquored up, and they'll want to take pictures, and they'll hug them, and they'll take pictures with their arms around their waist and sometimes slip their hand down, sometimes give them kisses on the cheek. And these women, every single one of them, said this is kind of part of the deal. And they never felt comfortable enough to complain about it, because cheerleaders know that from auditioning every year, there are thousands of women that may take their place and may be willing to take their place. And so there's very much a culture of just be quiet, look pretty, handle it as smoothly as possible, and move on. And it shocked me just kind of how normalized it has become, I guess, over the years.
Juliette?
Yeah, what struck me the most was that there was this culture of silence that has been around the teams for many years and continues. And that's not only a little bit of what John said, which was they're basically threatened every day saying, if you don't follow our rules, of which we have 75,001 rules for you, what you look like, what color lipstick you have to wear, what you're going to wear to the gym and from the gym, and which restaurants you can be at based on where the NFL players or NBA players might be eating that night. They're scared into thinking that if they break any of the rules, they'll be kicked off the team because they're easily replaceable. I know one of the cheerleaders I talked to said that every day we're reminded that there's thousands of girls who would take our place today for free. And there, another thing that really, really struck me was that most of them sign these confidentiality agreements, which may or may not be part of their contracts, which they remember signing, but none of them seem to have a copy of, because it's not they're not legally bound to get a copy of them. And so they're afraid to speak out because of that, too, thinking, wait a minute, I signed this agreement saying I'm not supposed to share anything with media or any outside sources about what went on with me and my time with the NFL or NBA or NHL, whatever it might be. So they're afraid to even raise their hand and say, listen, I was sexually harassed during my time, because they know if they do complain, it'll be just, it's the little person against the big corporation. And we know how that turns out most of the time.
Yeah. And I guess that begs the question, how much of what they endure is because of what you just talked about in terms of knowing how many other girls would take their place in a heartbeat, how many they saw at auditions, how few get the job and how many want the job, versus just this, again, like you said, this silence from the teams, these NDAs, and just doing what they're told. Obviously, your answer is probably going to be a combination of all of this, but they're clearly in a non-leveraged position, and they're being taken advantage of it for that reason.
Yeah, I'll jump in and say I think you're right. I think it is a combination. The culture is such that when cheerleaders really kind of made their way into popular culture in the late 70s with like the Dallas Cowboys, and basically every NFL team at the time, for the most part, created an imitation of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders in terms of the skimpy outfits, in terms of the dancing, trying to establish some team of beautiful women to be seen on the sidelines, to give a respite to what's going on in the field, to fill airtime between plays and so on. And that culture has always been, let's pay them very little because we don't need to. Let's sexualize them, but they seem to be willing. And we can just look at our auditions and realize how many women are willing to do this. And we can subject them to all these things. We can put rules on them that don't apply to the players. And we can basically take advantage of their willingness to do this. And that's now been going on for 40 years. And it's really no different than it was in the late 70s. There's never been any sort of organization, sort of unionization. Very few people have spoken up for all the reasons that we're talking about until now. And I think this is kind of a tangential storyline that we're following from the Me Too movement, that people are saying, wait a second, you mean I didn't have to put up with this entire time? And so there's now starting to become a little bit of an enlightenment or a reckoning. And this is just another one of those dominoes that we're seeing as part of a broader movement.
This sort of, again, this is the lack of a better word, the sexualization of cheerleaders. I mean, back in the day, and dating myself, but high school cheerleaders, I remember cheering for us. It was 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? It was cheers, right? It doesn't seem like what we see now as cheerleading is cheerleading. It is dancing. It is, again, for lack of a better word, the sort of sexualization of cheerleading teams. Is that directly coming from the Cowboys of years past? Is that something with culture and society? I'm just interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that the Cowboys obviously were the first to turn cheerleaders into dancers. And if you ask any of these, especially NFL cheerleaders, they'll really not refer to themselves as cheerleaders. They say that they are dancers. And many of them have really extensive professional dancing backgrounds, whether it's in a classical ballet or hip hop or tap dancing or modern dance. And you'd be really surprised that they've been training for most of their lives to end up on the fields on Sunday doing things that I'm sure that the 5 or 6 year old little cheerleader, little girl, when they were training for dancing, they never dreamed that they'd be doing. But I think that they consider themselves dancers, and they realize that most of the people who look at them don't. They consider the fans, they know that the fans look at them as sex objects, and more, yeah, it's just more eye candy, but they personally think that they are professional dancers, and they're smart enough to know that they are sex symbols, but also smart enough to know that it doesn't give anybody the right to touch them in an unwanted, if they don't want it.
Yeah, Andrew, tag on to that. Everyone I've talked to sees it that way that Juliet's describing, and they wish they could be taken more seriously. Like, they realize that they're being seen and perhaps marketed very one-dimensionally, and they wish people could see how articulate we are, how much we might have to offer, what our real ambitions are, what our life is outside of dancing and cheerleading. But there has been a very narrow scope in terms of what the teams and the leagues have projected on these women, and there, you know, again, has been very little ability for them to speak up and say, wait a second, let me tell you about what I really believe in terms of my charity work or whatever else. We don't give them last names now. We don't do that partly to protect them from their identities, but they don't have many of these rights. They're kind of this squad of what the teams think are beautiful faces but we don't want to know too much about them. We don't want them to be too politically active. We don't want them to express too many religious beliefs. Just do your thing the way we've molded it for 40 years and don't be a squeaky wheel.
I think that's exactly right. And what's interesting to me is that you have a lot of statements from teams and they're all kind of boilerplate. We respect women. We respect diversity, integrity, et cetera. But as you just said, John, this, when I see cheerleader on websites or calendars or off-season pictorials, they're usually in bikinis. They're usually some kind of pinup. So again, there is that, you are stating that they want to be seen as more than that, but the teams seem to continue this depiction of them as these sexualized, you know, what this is what they're showing them as.
I think this is the problem here for not only the cheerleaders, but also society, who's, you know, people might be looking at these cheerleaders and thinking, why would you ever want to do this? You're just, right. Shaking your body parts in front of people. One of the cheerleaders I talked to said, yeah, we realize that everybody thinks we're stupid. And they're not really quite sure how to get around that, because they're portrayed in these ways, not only on game day, where they're wearing basically nothing when they're dancing at times, but also in these calendars where some teams have them dressed in their uniforms around town. Other teams have them dressed in nothing, just a towel or a scarf or something on the beach in Aruba. So and I think that the cheerleaders, some of them consider themselves models. Others think, well, I'm just showing my body because I'm really physically fit and I'm not ashamed at what I look like. So it's this different mentality between what the cheerleaders think that they're doing and what the public thinks of cheerleaders. I think there's a big disconnect there.
John, in your reporting, can you come up with a sort of standard why these women get into it? Because as we all know, it's not for the money. So, and as you guys have detailed so effectively, they do put up with a lot of abuse. So why are hundreds of people showing up for tryouts for 20 jobs? And what is the clear motivation, if there is one?
Right. I think most of them don't know exactly what it entails. So these stories might enlighten some of these women who maybe otherwise would be clamoring to go try out. As Juliet said, many of these women are very accomplished dancers, or they've been cheerleading and or dancing their entire lives. We now see, you know, young girls especially starting to cheer at very young ages. And this is the pinnacle. I mean, what bigger stage could you have than an NFL team, an NFL game, national TV, potential to actually go dance in front of a billion people at the Super Bowl if that's where your team goes? This is, in their minds, it could not be any better than this. And they've given the NFL and the other leagues, most leagues now all have cheerleaders, kind of the benefit of the doubt that because of your stature as a Premier League or the major sports league, of course you'll take care of us. Now, they all seem a little bit surprised and maybe disappointed once they get into it, but there's very much an ambivalence. Even the ones who are telling us these stories, these kind of lurid stories about being sexually harassed, every one of them that I've talked to said, but I love so many parts of this job. It was so exciting. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun, but I just wish they'd respect us. I wish they would pay us better. I wish we had better security when we went into the stands. And even going into the stands, that's sometimes the most fun part because some fans are great. But then again, then I walk into places and I get groped, and that's the worst part of the job. There's just a really wide ambivalence about this job. And again, they've never really had a voice loud enough or strong enough to be able to say, can we take care of the bad parts of this job?
You know, on that, I do have to segue to that. That I found the most eye-opening part of your reporting, that we understand that cheerleaders are on the sidelines and that they'll go on trips and they'll go to events and they'll go, as you said, the playoffs and Super Bowl. But I, having even been in the NFL for 10 years, although we didn't really have cheerleaders in Green Bay, we had local college teams. But I was surprised that these women were sent to private areas with, as you said, liquored up fans. And you even talked about a group of Redskin cheerleaders going to a home where who knows what could happen. And I was very surprised by that. Was this something that was unique to just a couple teams, or they're actually going to private suites and even homes? Juliet?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was just unique to one specific team or a couple specific teams, because we hadn't heard from cheerleaders from every single franchise. But that's probably what'll resonate with me the longest, is that these women were, you know, they signed a contract, and most of the times in a contract said you agree to do, you know, 20-30 appearances every year. We go to hospitals and sports camps, and right. We meet the military and do all these things. You know, we dance in parades, and wow, does that sound great? Or go overseas with the USO tours. I mean, that sounds pretty appealing to a young woman who, you know, who maybe hasn't traveled very much, or would like to do some community service. But in the end, some of these teams are sending these women to private parties, whether it's high rollers in suites or whether it's just guys who call up the team and say, hey, listen, we'll pay several thousand dollars per girl for a couple of hours of coming to our party where we're watching television. There's a particular story you're talking about with the Redskins. There were six of the Redskins cheerleaders were hired out, and they ended up showing up at a party with just seven guys sitting there, seven guys in their 40s who were asking them, okay, which one's single? And do you want to have some drinks with us? So it was pretty appalling.
In those situations, would there be security? Would there be recourse if they did groping or even more than groping? I mean, I guess that was my question. Like, what if they really got uncomfortable, what would happen?
Well, you would think that they would leave, but I think that they were too scared to leave because not all of the women wanted to leave. And they were also scared if they left this person's house. And most of the time they had no idea who this person was. I mean, are they a big patron of the team? Are they the biggest sponsor? They had no clue. So,
right.
So they felt pressured to stay. There was absolutely no security there. There's nobody from the Redskins, nobody who's obviously representing anybody who would be an authority figure who you could say, hey, listen, I feel uncomfortable, you know, or even, you know, feel threatened. I'm not even sure if they were allowed to have their cell phones on at the time. So it's very dangerous, as some of the women had talked to me and said, because they just felt like they had nowhere to turn if something would happen. And one of them said, yeah, what if somebody would have dragged us into a room and locked the door? Who would have even known what was going on then? And that's the biggest, I think for me, that's the biggest problem, because there's the known issue of going to a game, sometimes somebody grabbing you around the waist, maybe pinching your rear end or something, which, you know, has happened and people have heard those stories. But the untold stories are the ones where these teams are hiring out the women to do private parties. And one of the women, I think in the story, says, you know, it's just like calling up for an escort. You call and say, how many, and the team would ask, how many women do you want? Do you want them to dance or not? And, you know, they'll pay you a couple thousand dollars, and a couple beautiful, you know, really fit women will walk through your door several hours later. It just seems totally unsafe.
And of course the women aren't the ones getting that money.
Are not getting that money, or say that again.
I just said that, of course, the women are the ones who are not getting at least most of that money. Not that that would okay some of these deals, but that money is team, you know, money that the team is collecting, and then they may pay them a small fee for their appearance fees. So it can be a moneymaker for these teams.
Absolutely.
Right. A lot of the women said it was about, they would get $100 for several hours, while the team would get $1,200 per person.
Yeah, this inequality, this inequity bargaining, this unconscionable kind of adhesion contracts that they sign, I guess the question is really, what can change? I know you talked to an attorney that's involved in helping these women. Don and I, before we started here, talked about potential unionization. Is there anything on the horizon that could somehow, beyond the publicity, which is great, somehow even the scales a bit, level the playing field, so these cheerleaders have some bargaining power and some strength, rather than just doing what they're told and feeling completely silenced and complaining about it?
Well, I think that the power of public opinion might go a long way now that these stories are starting to emerge. Teams may be pressured, because if women can start telling us more and more about what they go through and what they have gone through, teams may look really silly. And especially going forward, if, you know, we find out a year or two from now, these kinds of things are still going on. It's a huge public relations issue. Certainly the unionization is a possibility, though I have not caught wind of anybody really centralized saying we are going to pull all these women together. One of the fears I think that I would have, or that people might have, because this has happened in the past, because these are such low wage kind of sort of tangential groups, these cheerleading groups from, say, the ownership. I mean, the owners kind of keep hands off, so to speak, on these groups. And we've seen in the past when there has been some troubles, they've just disbanded the teams. It's happened in Buffalo. It happened in San Diego 40 years ago when one of the members posed for Playboy. They said it's just not worth it. So you'd kind of hate to see if these women truly, if there are women who truly want to do this, as long as they're being treated fairly, is for everything just to be disbanded because it's not worth the hassle. And I could see that being a potential solution for the NFL. It's just, forget it. Just fire them all.
You wonder if it could, you know, something like your article could somehow take away what Juliet just talked about, these sort of sending them over, like the Redskins situation. Again, these are maybe incremental changes that could be made, but as you said, John, these teams could react entirely the other way. So it's, if we got hassles, you know, we'll just move on, which is unfortunate.
Well, that's true. That some of the women had mentioned to me, too, that that's another reason why they weren't complaining about these things, because the teams would say, hey, listen, if you complain about the way you're treated here, well, one, not only can you be replaced tomorrow, but, you know, we might the team might look at us and might fold the whole program. And do you want to destroy professional cheerleading for all the generations to come? So like John said before, a lot of these women actually love cheerleading. They love the camaraderie. They love 95% of the fans. They love the whole idea of it, and just the other idea of having this whole thing implode when they complain about, you know, being treated correctly, legally being treated well. They don't want to say anything because they don't want to ruin it for the rest of the cheerleaders to come.
And John, before we started, you mentioned some conversation or maybe an anecdote you had about a television producer or director or executive. And it is, it really is prominent in watching the games where there are close-ups of these cheerleaders. We're like, oh, you know, that is in your face. And you mentioned that that is certainly by design.
Yeah, I just this morning saw some footage from about 40 years ago that showed an interview with television producers, Monday Night Football producers, saying, cut away, show us the cheerleaders. You know, we have a choice between plays. We can either show a huddle of men bent over, or we could show cheerleaders up close. And that's been part of the mythology, I guess, of especially at the NFL, but now other sports. Let's have these glamorous women, and that will sort of break up the action that's going on in the field. The question is, you know, have we not grown as a culture to see that, you know, what we've been doing now for 40 some years, there might be a different way to do this, a better way to do this, a fairer way to do this.
Yeah. And my last couple of questions, the one thing we have focused, and again, that's my background, that the bulk of your reporting on NFL, it obviously extends beyond that. Did you find it much more prevalent in NFL than other leagues? Why was that the bulk of your reporting?
I don't think it was the bulk of our reporting. It was the bulk of the women who had reached out to us and who is, you know, we talked to, let's say we talked to one woman from one NFL team. Well, she was able to talk to some of the other people she cheered with in the past, and then those people would call us. So it's a good question. I don't know whether the other leagues are treating their women slightly better or putting them in less precarious situations when it comes to promotions away from the stadium or away from the arena, but it seems like it kept coming back to the NFL and how those cheerleaders were treated, not only by the fans but also by their management.
Yeah, I think a couple of things, Andrew, are at play here. One, the NFL was kind of the original at this. Two, they are the big pro sports giant, I guess, at least in terms of television viewers. And so they have the history of the cheerleaders and sort of their size. But I will say I've spoken now to women who have also been part of the National Hockey League, part of Major League Baseball. Some people may be surprised that there are cheerleaders in baseball. So it's widespread, and I think we'll start hearing more and more stories from other sports, because these other sports, frankly, over the years, have seen the success of the cheerleading programs in the NFL and have mimicked them to some extent in their own. The NBA has dancers. Many people I've spoken to that have done both. The NBA seems to be a little bit more forward-thinking in terms of a lot of the treatment of the women, but it's they're still running into a lot of the same issues. And the other leagues are have been for the last 10 or 20 or 30 years sort of mimicking the success that they've seen the NFL have with cheerleaders. And so a lot of these programs are kind of mirror images of the NFL. So it goes across sports, but I think the NFL is kind of the big elephant in the room, so to speak.
And the question about fraternizing, I know your colleague Ken Belson talked about New Orleans Saints cheerleaders that were prohibited from certain Instagramming and social and had to actually leave restaurants if New Orleans Saints players came into restaurants, etc. Did you find that was fairly universal in terms of the non-fraternizing with players and even directed to sort of stay clear of any interactions whatsoever?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the bottom lines with the team rules is don't talk about the players. Don't be in the same place as the players, especially if that's outside of the stadium. Don't mention the players on your social media, even if it's like, oh, hey, you know, the quarterback just walked by. You can't say anything. It's as if you live in two separate worlds, which is, I would say, it's universal. Every single person I talked to said that's the bottom line of being an NFL cheerleader, is that you have nothing to do with the rest of the NFL.
Yeah, I've seen rule books, for example, that say you will be fired instantly if you are seen in the locker room of the team. Which, of course, plenty of women can walk in and out of the locker room. Media members do it all the time. But a cheerleader walks in there, and she will be fired instantly. They advise them to walk around the stadium in different ways to avoid the players. Don't take pictures with the players. Don't be seen with the players. As you mentioned, if you're at a restaurant and eating dinner, and a player walks in, it's your responsibility to get up, walk out. They just can't, as Juliet says, they have to be in two different worlds, and it's really up to the cheerleader to make sure that separation exists.
Yeah, that's what I was going to follow up with. That you just said it. That what if the player is the one initiating everything? The cheerleader is just supposed to continue to walk away, ignore.
Yeah, it's one of the many rules that these cheerleaders now are saying are unfair and are an example of gender discrimination. That. They are held to a much different standard than any of the players. We have a story out today that talks about religious discrimination, and a woman's alleging that, you know, she's not allowed to say anything about her Christianity. Meanwhile, we see players kneel on the field, for example, or
sure,
start an interview by saying, first of all, I'd like to thank God, that sort of thing. Across a wide spectrum of rules, the women are held to a much different standard and a tighter standard.
I think that kind of brings up my last question point. You mentioned, John, quickly earlier about the Me Too movement and what exactly is bringing this on now. You know, we live in a fractionalized society. A lot of this is out there from the White House down in terms of misbehavior. And even in the NFL, we've got the Carolina Panthers for sale based on some misconduct by their owner. That is all to say, this public opinion, shaming, et cetera, could change it. But do we see this as temporary? Do we see real change afoot? And if so, what can change? Again, back to unionization, is there leadership? Is there a move afoot from league or teams to change? I guess that's sort of the lingering question we have here. Juliet?
It has to change. I mean, I don't think this is just a temporary thing that women suddenly realize that they have the power to speak up and that other women and other men will stand behind them. In terms of the cheerleaders, I've had some suggestions from the cheerleaders about how things could be made better, including getting rid of these promotions where they're going to personal houses or yachts, things like that. They don't want to do it. Most of the women don't want to do it. They shouldn't be made to do it. Maybe change their uniforms when they're going out with the fans, going out in the stands to deal with the fans. Do they have to wear a tiny two-piece, or can they wear something that they would wear maybe to a VA hospital or a military hospital or a children's camp or something, which would be, you know, a tank top, a sweatshirt and sweatpants. It would be a uniform, could be sparkly also, but it would limit the ability for male fans to obviously grasp them around the waist and give them a squeeze. Just doing little things like that would change things, would help to empower the women, just give them a little bit more feeling that they have control over how they're treated.
John?
Yeah, it's interesting because I had a friend recently, just in the last few days, say to me, like, can you imagine if, for example, somebody really rich, say like an Ellen DeGeneres, bought an NFL team? How great would the cheerleaders be? They'd be so much fun. They'd be so much different. And could somebody really change the paradigm? Right now, what we see across the NFL and really across all the leagues is a very similar idea of what a cheerleader and dancer is. And that is somebody with very few clothes, beautiful by some standards that the American society has decided is beautiful, and dancing around. And imagine if somebody came along and just totally upended that paradigm. Maybe didn't eliminate it, but just redid it. We see, for example, the Baltimore Ravens have many male cheerleaders. The Los Angeles Rams just hired two male cheerleaders. Could that kind of thing, where you almost go back to the more old-fashioned college approach, sort of upend the paradigm and have people sort of open their eyes and say, you know what, we don't have to accept what the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders started 40-some years ago and that everybody else now imitates. Maybe there's a different way to do this.
Well, this is great. Really appreciate it. Juliet McCurr, John Branch, New York Times, reporting on cheerleaders and what they go through and groping, et cetera, harassment in their daily lives with these teams. This is great. Thanks so much for being with me on the Business of Sports, guys.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And now, feature of the podcast we started a few weeks ago where you ask your questions. I'll try to answer them. Had a few this week. I'm going to answer one ahead. Keep in mind, you can call in, leave your voicemail question, and I will answer at 484-416-5654. 484-416-5654. I'll answer your questions. The one we have this week is from Jim.
Jim Wallace in Atlanta. I have a question about Kentavious Street, the NC State defensive lineman who tore his ACL when he was at the New York Giants working out. How does that work relative to insurance, both medical insurance for having it repaired and any loss of value insurance? The prospects typically have insurance. Just curious how that all works out. Any insight you can provide? Love all you do. Thanks for the podcast.
Thank you, Jim. And a really good question. It's obviously there's no right answer. There's no answer that fits everywhere. You have a player coming to a team for a workout, and usually the workouts are going to be on the pro day at the school, but teams are allowed to bring in quote-unquote close-by prospects to do actual work. You know, in my experience with the Packers, whenever we had a tryout, a workout, unsigned player, he would have to sign, and to be honest, sign his life away. He would have to sign that we have no responsibility, we the team, are not liable for any injury suffered, and we did have some injuries suffered. We had some ACLs. We had a couple Achilles, torn Achilles during those tryouts. But there was no liability attaching to the team because the player signed away those rights. I would think the Giants would have similar language and similar requirement that they sign these forms before they get on the field, that they're not going to be liable. Now, once the player's drafted, if they get hurt during a mini camp and off-season workout, typically, players sign something that says, if you're the fifth pick in the fifth round, whatever it is, you're going to get that money, and you can work out and do off-season workouts and do mini camps before signing your contract. It's still going to apply. But obviously, these are players not drafted. These are players without teams having any rights to them. And yes, if you had to say it, they're out of luck. You asked about loss of value insurance, any insurance. First of all, maybe he has health insurance through his parents, through some policy he gained in college. Those are other things. Loss of value is where you actually get a policy through a Lloyd's or some insurer where if you lose spots of where you're quote-unquote projected at the time when you get the policy and it happens due to injury or something else, you can collect on that. I don't know if this player Street had that. It's very rare. We had Jake Butt last year from Michigan that had a loss of value policy. There were differing reports on how much he was able to collect or not. But you brought it up. This is not a good situation, and it happens, seems to, every year. These players, so many players for so few jobs, thousands of players trying to be in that 250 that are drafted or the 200 or so that are signed right after the draft. This is a really tough situation. It happened. It'll happen again. I would think the Giants protected themselves in that, and that's what happens. Appreciate it, Jim, and I'll answer more questions on the next podcast. Really hope you enjoyed delving into the underworld of cheerleading, primarily the NFL. It's an eye-opening piece in the New York Times, something that we'll continue to follow on the business of sports and whether there are changes made in relationships between teams and cheerleaders, what they can and can't do, and how they're treated going forward. Something to watch. Hope you enjoyed the business of sports with Andrew Brandt every week. Give us a high rating if you will. Appreciate it. Mention it to a friend. You can follow us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, RossTucker.com, wherever you hear your podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at Andrew Brandt, and I'll be back next week with another edition of the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.
Thanks for listening to the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also get additional insider insight by listening to the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, Fantasy Feast, Even Money, and College Draft Podcasts, all at RossTucker.com or wherever podcasts are found.